From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What's the best piece of reporting you read or heard or saw this year? A story that challenged your thinking or made you see the world a little differently?
If you were flying in to Mumbai, you fly into the international airport and then you get out of the airport and you make a left. In front of you, you would see a very sleek smoke glass Hyatt and then an ornate Sheraton Grand Murata that's made of pink Jaipur stone. And before you get to them, there's this long wall festooned with advertisements for ceramic floor tiles. And it said, beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever on the wall. And there was a break in the wall. And if you turn down through that and you go down a rocky road and you make a right, you open up into this whole world that's hidden behind the wall, which is the world of the people of Vanuatu.
Catherine Boo spent 3 years reporting on the people of Vanuatu. 3,000 squatters who live crammed into 300-some huts on the edge of a lake of sewage. Her book, Behind the Beautiful Forever, has won the National Book Award. Vanuatu has to be one of the most squalid places on Earth. But as Boo told Steve Paulson, that is not the point.
I think that a lot of the writing that gets done about poverty or poor communities focuses on the physical aspects, and particularly in India, on the squalor. And of course, in my book, there's squalor, there's the sewage lake.
Well, you tell stories about people to put food on the table, trapping frogs and rats and rummaging through the sewage to find stuff to eat.
Right, right. And you know, they have this idea that the frogs at the Naupata slum near the Intercontinental Hotel actually taste better than the ones in the sewage lake. But what I'm really interested in is not writing about passive people with no agency trapped in a miserable place. I'm interested in who these people are and how they are striving to find a niche in the global economy. Every morning, thousands of waste pickers fanned out across the airport area in search of vendable excess, a few pounds of the 8,000 tons of garbage that Mumbai was extruding every day. These scavengers darted after crumpled cigarette packs tossed from cars with tinted windows. They dredged sewers and raided dumpsters for empty bottles of water and beer. Each evening, they returned down the slum road with gunny sacks of garbage on their backs. Abdul would be waiting at his rusty scale.
Well, tell me about Abdul, one of the central figures in your story. How did he end up selling trash for a living?
It was the work his father could find. He first collected trash like everybody else around the airport, and then he became a buyer and seller of this trash, a middleman. So he had this eldest son, this diffident, awkward eldest son, and he also had 8 other children. So the only way to support the family would be if this child take up the family business.
And then so there's this whole sort of army of people out there trying to gather trash, competing with each other to try to get the best stuff.
And one of the things is that competition has just become increasingly brutal. I talk about a kid named Sunil, who is 12 or 13 when I first met him. He'd essentially been raising himself since his mother died of tuberculosis. And he's undersized. His great dream is to eat enough to grow, to start growing. And so he's working as hard as he possibly can to collect enough trash to be able to feed himself enough to jumpstart his system. But one of the things that happens because he's undersized is, I mean, he'll go to a dumpster and then other people will flash knives or throw stones to keep him away from the immense wealth that people see in rich people's garbage. Or he will spend day and night collecting. And somebody will be waiting who's bigger than him, and then will take his stuff.
So it's brutal.
Get the money for it. It's absolutely brutal. But to me, that's not the end of the story. That's the beginning of the story, because a kid like Sunil is not just going to accept that it's impossible. He's going to use his intelligence to try to find another way.
And we should talk about this. I mean, the central drama of your story is there's an argument that pops up between these two families who live right next to each other, Abdul's family and Fatima, this woman who's known as One Leg. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, well, let me just tell you about Fatima. Fatima was born with one of her legs ended at the knee. She shares a wall with Abdul's family. On her side of the wall is poverty, true poverty. On their side of the wall, because of Abdul's business, life is improving. There is now a television set, and Abdul's mother decides she wants a slightly better hut. And Abdul thinks no, because people are going to be jealous. But she says, no, we've earned this. I want my family to live in a more dignified setting. And the construction of beginning to fix the house ends up getting rubble in Fatima's rice. And through a whole series of events, Fatima decides to use the only weapon she can think of, which is her own body, to destroy Abdul and his family's hopes. And she sets herself on fire. And from her hospital bed, she accuses Abdul, his father, and his sister of committing this crime. She says that they set her on fire.
Well, and the tragedy here is, well, all kinds of tragedies, but the specific one is Abdul and his family were totally blameless. They had nothing to do with this. Everyone knew Fatima had set herself on fire, and yet Abdul and his father and his sister all ended up in jail.
Right, and one of the reasons that they ended up in jail was that the police also knew that they had been making a little money on garbage. And so the police saw this as an opportunity to extract some of that money.
So Abdul and his family, they were supposed to bribe the officials. They were supposed to bribe the police, for instance, to get off, but they wouldn't do that.
They were asked to bribe the police, the people who took the witness statements. They were supposed to bribe Fatima's family. They were supposed to bribe the slumlord. So many hands came out to try to take some of this money that Abdul had earned and that they had been saving for a small plot of land outside the city where they felt that people wouldn't call them garbage and might treat them with respect.
And they ended up, I mean, in jail. They got beaten, too. I mean, this was horrible.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties when I do my work is that you, at the end and all through, you're just constantly fact-checking to make sure that you've got it right. And one of the most difficult parts of that is that in these times, I repeatedly had to ask people like Abdul and his mother to relive some of the worst nights of their life, and it was extremely painful. But they felt that if other people had a sense in depth of the experiences of people like themselves, that maybe there was a possibility for change.
What's happened to Abdul's family?
I don't want to tell you. I want you to care and to know and to to find out. But I was with Abdul and his mother and father and the children a few weeks ago, giving them copies of the book, advanced copies of the book. And everybody in the family was excited except for Abdul. And Abdul was like, yeah, whatever. I got work to do. And off he went.
He's still in the trash business.
He's glad that the book is out there, but it's that's not the biggest issue in his life right now. The biggest issue is making sure that his family gets another shot at middle-class security.
Yeah. Now, there's also a story behind the story here, and that's how you, as a privileged white woman from America, came to tell this story, because you would seem to be totally out of place in Adiwadi, and yet somehow you managed to come to know a certain segment of Indian society that even many Indians who've read your book say they didn't even know existed.
In the beginning, when I came, it was, I was the found entertainment. I was just a freak show. And it was impossible to do the kind of reporting that I practice, which is not sticking a microphone in front of somebody's face immediately. It's spending time with them. It's going where they go, doing what they do, whether it's stealing from recycling bins at the airport or teaching kindergarten. And at first, I couldn't find a translator who wanted to work in this very patient style in conditions that were quite terrible. There was malaria, there was dengue fever, and there was tuberculosis. So it was a lot to ask another person. So I would just start coming back day after day on my own and at night. And I think that they understood that I wasn't afraid to be in their community on my own. I think that made an impression. People said it did.
Did you have an ethics on how you approached this, on what you felt was the right way to tell this story? I mean, given the fact that you are writing about people who are very poor and, often their stories are not told well.
I have an ethic in my work that my experience, like, you know, my going into the slum, my falling into the sewage lake and all these other things are not part of the main story. So I keep myself out of it and try to make as clear as possible the enormous intellectual capabilities that are at work among the people who are trying to find a way into the middle class.
This is a point worth reiterating. I mean, there's no first-person narration in the story. I mean, the word I never even appears until the author's note at the very end of
right.
the book. I mean, you've deliberately kept yourself out of the story, which is, frankly, what a lot of American journalists would not do.
Well, I feel that the subjects that I care most about, whether it's in America or in India, are things that most people don't want to read. And so my job is to understand that I have a limited amount of space. I want every sentence to count. I want every sentence to bring you closer, not to me as a writer, but to the people that you might not otherwise meet. I want you to understand the way that a kid like Sunil, this young scavenger who's raising himself, I want you to understand his immense appreciation for natural beauty and how even he would rather some days go hungry than to pick some beautiful flowers he's found amid the trash in behind a wall at the airport and sell those flowers in traffic by the Hyatt. He wants to believe in the beauty of the world, and it's that important to him. And the more that I'm talking about myself, the less time I have to tell the readers about a kid like that.
Catherine Boo won the National Book Award for Behind the Beautiful Forevers. We're talking about journalism this hour and the art of telling the story. Of course, great journalism doesn't always need words. There's a photograph I saw recently. It was taken in a giant trash heap in Nairobi. There's garbage. As far as you can see, garbage smoldering. In the middle, there is a young boy walking, head down, picking up trash. And behind him, you can see a huge marabou stork silhouetted against the sky, taking flight. That photograph is, well, it's haunting, it's beautiful, it's disturbing. And it was taken by photojournalist Brendan Bannon. He lives and works in Africa. And Strange Champs tracked him down.
Brendan, tell me about this picture. Is there a story behind it?
Yeah, so that picture, I mean, the setting of that picture is a place that I found really interesting. It's a place that taught me how to see in Africa. It's at the edge of the Dandora dump site, which is Nairobi's largest dumping grounds for municipal waste. And it's this hive of activity where people are on a daily basis kind of scavenging. And I was really drawn to it first because I saw a woman selling small jars of jelly, maybe an ounce or so. And I asked the person who was showing me around, I said, what's going on with that? Where did she get the jelly? Why is she selling it? And they said, oh, it's from the dump site over there. And my friend Mohammed said, yeah, when people fly in to Nairobi from abroad and they don't finish their meals, they're finished here in the slum. So these little jars of jelly were the remnants of unfinished first-class meals that were picked up by people scavenging and then sold on to this lady who sold them on to other people in the slum. And it was that kind of inventiveness that really blew me away. It really stuck with me, and I think it really instructed me to look for ways that people are able to invent a life and to start to look for that on the terms of where I am, not the terms of where I came from.
There's another series of photos I wanted to ask you about, and these are pictures you took at the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. The landscape is kind of ghostly. The sky is bleached white. The ground is just dust. The trees are dead. You can see a few bare branches. And in the middle of these photos, there's one single vibrant shout of color. There's a little girl in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, there's a boy who's leading some cattle.
Yep. The girl in the tree was sitting at the edge of a long line of people waiting to be registered. There were close to 1,000 people arriving each day at the time that I was there photographing. And arriving after these grueling walks through the desert and kind of perilous border crossings. For me, that girl sitting in the tree alone at the edge was just doing what kids do. She was playing. She was trying to get a better view of what was going on, just observing everything. And, you know, as an observer myself, it's a way of, I guess, putting yourself into the picture. I'm wondering what I'm looking at the same time she's wondering what she's looking at, I think.
Well, I was struck by those because they're photographs of a crisis, of something terrible that's happening, but they're beautiful. And I guess I was wondering about the role of beauty in your work.
Well, I think you want to take pictures that people want to look at. And finding the beauty, finding the wonder in a situation like that is paying homage to the fact that daily life goes on in a tragedy. I think a lot of how I approach a situation like that was developed because I spent years taking care of my mom, who had multiple cirrhosis. And from the outside, people would look at that situation and think that she was somebody who was suffering. But with this front row seat that I had to her struggle, I saw somebody that was surviving every day first. And there was an incredible beauty and power to that. And I take that, I think, as a challenge when I go out into these situations to see what is it that people are doing in their lives. And while they may be in the midst of a tragedy, they're also continuing to try to live their lives. They're continuing to try to be strong for each other. They're continuing to love the people that they love. They're mourning maybe the people that they lost. They're doing everything they can to maintain their dignity. And there is something, I think, that's fundamentally beautiful in that.
So you've spent years documenting refugee crises, AIDS crises, drought, war. You launched a new project, Daily Dispatches, which is intentionally very different in nature. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, Daily Dispatches is hopefully an ongoing project that allows myself and a writer to tell stories of everyday life. We focused for the first chapter on Nairobi, and over the course of a month reported 25 different stories. We looked for stories that surprised us and hoped that those stories would surprise other people. And in finding those stories, hope that we would reflect the complexity of life in an African city, to get away from, you know, the narrow kind of telling of Africa as a place of deep tragedy. There's also incredible vitality and inventiveness to life that people need to understand and see.
Hmm. What are some of the photographs you've taken with Daily Dispatches that people have been most interested in?
We spent a morning. We woke up at about 5 o'clock and got on the road quickly to the edge of Nairobi to spend a morning with 18 or 19 orphaned elephants. They were casualties of the ivory trade, and they were being cared for by this incredible group of Kenyan caregivers. So that was one.
What else?
We met with a group of grandmothers who were learning karate for self-defense. They were living in the same slum that I took the photograph that I described at the opening of the show, and had banded together to learn self-defense because there was a problem of sexual violence. So it was a kind of courageous response to a difficult circumstance. I have so many stories that we saw that.
Brendan, I'm curious about your relationship with your camera and whether it's changed over time. I remember talking with another photographer who said that her camera started out as a shield between her and the brutality sometimes of what she was photographing. And I wonder what your take on your relationship with your camera is.
I mean, it's a passport, I think. It's a passport into other worlds. It's funny, sometimes I find myself pulling the camera away from my eye when I see something that's really remarkable.
How come?
Because I don't want it to be there. I want to be able to see and confirm that I'm seeing it with my own two eyes. It's kind of a double check. I'll take the camera away, I'll look, and then I'll be reminded that I'm there to photograph, and put the camera back up and take the shot if it's still happening. I mean, ultimately, I think that as a photographer and as a journalist, there's a principle that I share with students when I'm teaching, and it's to tell people that we're the least important people in the room, that in the end, we're not there to tell our own stories. We're there to tell somebody else's. And tell it as truthfully as we can.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Photojournalist Brendan Bannon talking with Anne Strangechamps. I'll bet you'd like to see those photos, wouldn't you? Well, they're on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about journalism this hour and the art of telling the story. Sometimes great journalism isn't so much about the telling as it is about the getting. Piers Ebersche won a Pulitzer Prize for the reporting he did for the New York Times. He did it from his home, Waziristan. It's in the Pashtun area of Pakistan. He risked his life to get his stories out, to the point that he cannot go home again because Pashtun is the hidden Pakistan.
Exactly. And this is, here comes the paradox of the situation, that at one hand, it's such a little known place, but at the other hand, it's so much in the news. You hear about Al-Qaeda, it's in Waziristan. You hear about Taliban commanders, they're in Waziristan. You hear about the drone strikes, they are taking place in Waziristan. So it's so all over the news. But if you dig beneath the surface, you really don't know what who the people are, what the culture is. And in my case, as I had lived there, I had spent time there, my family is still there, I was in a unique position to tell the story to an American audience.
There are reasons that the story isn't widely known. You put yourself in some danger in going there, and I assume you put your family in some danger as well.
Yes, you are right. Again, I mean, working with an American newspaper, it was a big risk, not only for me, as you said, even for my family. So I would go there in very low profile. And eventually in 2007 was the last time I visited my village in Waziristan, because after that it was impossible. So what I would do is bring out sources which I had made, people who grew up with me later on ended up with the military or with the Taliban. That's how I used to report and bring out the story.
But at the same time, you were local enough. They could trust you because...
Yeah, I knew people. I had spent time there. I knew who to trust. In 2008, I was detained by the Taliban with my photographer and the local guide and the driver.
I actually have read this story, and it sounds as though you knew this was a possibility, especially because the photographer was not a local.
The photographer made a mistake. He didn't listen to my advice, and he came to the place where I was interviewing a local person, but that photographer had to pass through a Taliban checkpost. At that time, the Talibans were invisible because they were sitting under a tree, so you couldn't see them.
You knew.
I knew.
And it was obvious to everyone that he was not local?
It was clear to me. First, he looked like a Talib himself. He had a long beard. The problem was that if you go there with a beard, the Taliban think that you have camouflaged yourself as them in order to penetrate them and spy on them. The other main factor was also the language. He couldn't speak Pashto.
The two of you were then taken by the Taliban, is that right?
Yes, we were taken to their prison. We were not chained as such as other prisoners were. We were treated relatively better because they were not sure who we really are. We didn't tell them that we are journalists, and especially with the New York Times, because it entailed other dangers.
You wouldn't want them to know you were from the New York Times.
Exactly, but we couldn't lie to them that we are from some other local newspaper or radio or television, because if they come to know the reality, then it put us in more danger. So we navigated that part, I think, quite well.
How long were you held?
We were held 3 nights, 4 days.
So why did they finally let you go?
They realized that we are journalists because the guy who was the spokesman for the Taliban in that part of the area, he was telling me that every day he had to change 2 batteries of his phone because every journalist in the world would call him asking for our release. So that was one reason, the pressure from the media. Second reason was my family went to them and said, he's a journalist. And it put the Taliban in our area. They asked the others. It's a tribal thing.
So you were released by the Taliban and then interrogated by the government.
Yes, actually, their interrogation was much longer and much harsher in the sense that they had to keep us awake the whole night while we had spent 3 sleepless nights in the prison with the Taliban. They had the same fears that we might be American spies.
In some ways, I suppose this must have been the situation you faced on a regular basis. Everyone wondered who you were.
Exactly, because, first of all, this journalism culture is new in our part of the world. In Pakistan, you will find a lot of journalists who are on the payroll of the intelligence agencies there. I mean, they work for government, they draw their even salaries from government being journalists. So, yeah, it was very difficult for me to explain to people.
But you worked with a number of journalists whose experiences have been, well, more difficult, in some cases, deadly. You've worked with journalists who have been killed because of what they've written, haven't you?
Yes. I knew a lot of people who I was in touch with, who I used to follow, who used to follow my work. I saw them being tortured. I saw them being picked up, some of them killed, detained and killed. So many of them lost to this conflict. That's why I left. I was threatened. I arrived here, and 3 weeks after what I was fearing could happen to me, happened to another journalist. He was picked up right in front of his house in the capital, Islamabad, tortured for 6 hours, humiliated. That was exactly what I was fearing, and that's what I was told that I should expect.
Picked up by the government?
Most probably by the government. So similarly, the other reporter last year, he was picked up in the same manner, tortured to death, basically. He was also planning to leave the country. So in my case, I was aware that this is coming, so I was lucky enough to leave in time.
I can see why this story is still a passionate one for you and is likely to be for a long time to come.
Yeah, this war is not going to end, at least for a few more years. So I have that emotional attachment with this story, and then my area is being hit.
Your home.
My home, exactly. And I think I know the story much better than many other reporters because of the fact that I am from there. I have access to
must drive you wild to have other people go tell a story that you know you could.
Exactly. That's why sometimes I miss being on the ground. I should have been there. This is the time that I should have continued my reporting. I should have brought out the stories from there. It's so important.
Pir Zabersha won a Pulitzer Prize for his New York Times stories from Pakistan. He lives in this country now. So tell us, what's the best reporting you read or heard this year? We asked our Facebook followers, and they put together a list of stories that made a difference to them this year. Discover something new. Make your own suggestions. Come to our Facebook page or to our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi there.
We're going to start today's program with a fellow named Robert.
Is it Epstein or Epstein?
Just think Einstein with an Ep.
Okay.
You probably recognize that, right? It's Radiolab, the public radio science show, hosted by veteran journalist Robert Krulwich and Jad Abumrad.
Relationships and love, like artificial intelligence, basically.
That is correct, yes.
There may be trouble ahead.
So, when did you decide to go on the computer to get a date?
So, Robert and Jad are not only two of the most engaging public radio hosts around, they are also inventing a whole new kind of broadcast journalism. Steve Paulson stopped by the Radiolab studio in New York, and he turned the mics around.
Now, that is such a great start to the program, partly because you never really say, this is a radio show about science.
And he would rather die than say
I'm assuming that you've thought about this. Do you have a philosophy of sort of how you do science on the radio?
Yeah, well, I don't know that this is a show about science
or about anything in particular. It's a show that exists at the point at which a lot of things come together. We don't do science in an applied science sort of way. I mean, you hear a lot of stuff on Science Friday, which is great, but it's about, you know, so-and-so made a thing, and now they have discovered a thing, and they can make something with it. We don't do that kind of stuff. We do the science that leads you to a greater sense of mystery, that bumps you into weird philosophical big ideas that you can just roll around in your head forever. We don't do answers, really. We do questions more than answers. Mm. I'm very inspired by science. My parents are scientists. I love the rigor of science, but I also hate the rigor of science. So in some sense, I'm in the mystery category. I like sort of the woo-woo stuff, but I also don't trust that in myself. So there's a way in which those two things wrestle, and this show is that wrestling match. It's science wrestling with mystery or with the unknown.
Or with just two curious fellows.
You know, yeah.
Who want. So that's the politics of this is very clear to me. When you live in a society where people who have information, and it's complicated information, want to decide things. Shall we not dirty the air or dirty the air? Or shall we recognize this is the beginning of life or that is the beginning of life? And these are actually turn out to be very important questions. if you don't have the science in you, then maybe you just should stay out of the conversation. But no, we don't think that. We think that you just come in to these things and you poke around and you ask stupid questions and you argue about what you've just learned. That's the theater of learning. And so a lot of journalism begins off stage, and the reporter just goes back and learns everything and gets it right and checks it with the editor and checks it with the source and then presents it to the audience as a finished piece of work, which is the authoritative reporting. We've decided to do unauthoritative reporting. But you can hear the authoring going on, you know, and fighting and all this. And that's, I think, how people actually come to knowledge. And so we want to just show you what that's like.
Mm-hmm. But are conversations.
How did you two meet?
I was in my office at ABC, and NYC needed someone to help them read a promotional material. I was like, who are you? And so, and it turned out that he had done a lot of the things that I had done 25 years earlier. So he'd gone to WBAI, a radio station in New York, so had I. He'd gone to Oberlin College, so had I. He was now at NPR, so had I been. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, well, that's weird. Like you're just doing, you're like hitting the stations of the cross in a different era. So maybe I should. So I was just curious, really. And then
we started having breakfast, you know? I mean, we did that for bi-weekly for a year.
Jed, were you intimidated with the idea of working with Robert? I mean, Robert, you know, is kind of a legend in broadcasting circles, certainly in public radio circles.
He had no idea who I was.
He was intimidating at the beginning. I've since learned the emotional landscape of Krulwich, and I'm now sort of an expert in it. But at the beginning, you know, Robert believes in something. He's going to damn well do it, and you have to sort of like a linebacker, like prepared, you have to be a nose tackle when you're, working through some of these creative issues. And I just, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing at the beginning. And so I would.
Would you defer to him?
Sure, at the beginning.
I think so.
Then, yeah.
However, the tsunami hit. As he became more able, it was probably Oedipal in some way, but he decided that, you know, he knew what he was doing, and he did. And so then we would have like door slamming.
Yeah, we went through really a period that was really, really hard where we would fight. We'd stop just two ticks shy of actual brawling, physical brawling.
Do you still fight?
He can see my fight coming about 13 miles away.
You're like an old married couple. Yeah. You know,
he can like walk over to the other side and sit on a bench and read a newspaper publicly until I'm done.
The same is true for him. He always kind of knows when.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we know that about each other. So we don't fight in that way anymore. Yeah.
I also have to ask you about this kind of strange studio setup that you have here. And we should say that I'm actually sitting in the Radiolab studio looking at both of you through a piece of glass. And that's the way you do the show, right? I mean, you're sitting in opposite studios but looking at each other through glass. So why?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I don't really
it's
know.
A very it's easy
some
answer
kind
to that.
Of engineer. I used to work with Ted Koppel at ABC. He had the same thing. You would come and he'd be in a studio and he'd be talking to a camera. And you'd be there with him. And you'd have your camera, I mean, you'd be on your screen, he'd be on your screen, and you couldn't, like, turn to the left and say, you know I don't mean that, Ted, because he would only talk to America or something. I don't know. I don't know why we have
America. It's completely different. It's completely different in this case because we edit things so damn much, we have to decouple the voices. And so the glass sort of keeps each of us acoustically separated so that when we edit things, you know, I mean, here's the thing, and you're experiencing this now, we're constantly talking over each other. And in the edit, what I'll do is I'll just pull our voices just slightly apart so that you can hear what we're saying. If you didn't do that, it'd be a total mess. We'd just be talking over each other constantly. Yeah. So I
want to play another clip from a different Radiolab show. This is about the Furby toy. You are talking with an MIT scientist named Freedom Baird.
Can you describe a Furby for those of us who...
Sure. Yeah. It's about 5 inches tall. And the Furby is pretty much all head. It's just a big, round, fluffy head with two little feet sticking out the front. It has big eyes.
Apparently, it makes noises.
Yep. If you tickle its tummy, it will coo. It would say, kiss me. So, you know, I spent about 10 weeks using the Furby. I would carry it around in my bag.
And one day, she's hanging out with her Furby, and she notices something
very eerie. What I discovered is if you hold it upside down, it will say,
me scared.
Me scared. Uh-oh. Me scared. Me scared. And me, as the, you know, the sort of owner slash user of this Furby, would get really uncomfortable with that and then turn it back up, upright.
Because once you have it upright, it's fine. It goes right back.
And then it's fine. So it's got some sensor in it that knows, you know, what direction it's facing.
Basically. Or maybe it's just scared.
Sorry.
Anyway, she thought, well, wait a second now. This could be sort of a new way that you could use to draw the line between what's human
and what's machine.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's this kind of emotional Turing test.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Can hear you.
Hey, if we actually wanted to do this test, could you help? How would we do it exactly?
How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Yeah?
You would need a group of kids.
Can you guys tell me your name?
I'm Olivia.
Louisa.
Turin.
Daryl.
Lila.
And I'm Sadie.
Okay. I mean, you're doing so much there. You're layering voices, layering sounds. How did you put that together?
It's like, I mean, if you watch film, I mean, it's there's a word for this. I forget what they call it, where the one scene bleeds into the other, you know, where you tail end of one scene, you're suddenly hearing audio from the succeeding scene, and then you cut to that scene, and it's just so commonplace. And so there's some way in which I feel like the techniques of film are guiding our choices here. And then there's the question, you know, well, we're working in this medium that has no pictures in it. What do you do? And it's those are the questions which just, in terms of craft, are always, that's why I get up in the morning. It's not stuff you discuss on the air, you know, but it's the thing that kind of like, what can we do to make you see a rainbow the way a shrimp sees a rainbow on the radio? It's just, it's a ridiculous question.
And that leads him to a church in Harlem where 100-some-odd people volunteer to come and sing. That's just fun.
Yeah. That's, there's no other reason to do it except because it's fun.
This is Radiolab, and today we're talking about color.
And we just learned that there are creatures out there who can see colors that we can't even imagine.
Like the amazing mantis shrimp.
I would so love to be a mantis shrimp and see what the mantis shrimp sees.
Yeah.
Now, another thing you do when you talk to these scientists, somehow you get them to talk like real people. And do you have tricks to that? I mean, so they don't sort of lapse into
Crowich is kind of the master at that. You're just kind of a clown isn't the right word because that means that you're just kind of
no. I'm actually
free flowing.
I'm consciously setting an emotional parameter. So I laugh and cough and do unbroadcasty things.
You interrupt a lot.
I interrupt him, interrupt myself. I act like no one's looking. But of course, the equipment and everything that's going on suggests quite otherwise. but it creates a dissonance in the person. They don't know what's going on.
Suddenly they're like, wait.
It's like you've gone to a dinner party and everyone shows up in pajamas. Like, what are you supposed to do?
It's exactly that way, actually.
So you're throwing them off their game to get them on their true game.
Yeah, and I've covered economics where businessmen talk, and I've covered diplomacy and war and generals in particular. And they have to be very, very careful because they're managing a life or death situation. And those are very orchestrated, and so are any entertainment. Like if you want to interview a celebrity, the celebrity has fixers and attached notary and has made deals and will include this and not include that. So it's actually, this is easy compared to that.
One final question. Do either of you have a dream Radiolab story? Maybe something that's hard to do, but sort of the thing that you really want to do.
I had one called Ants.
You have realized that
for
dream.
For years, I was waiting to do a story called How Ants Had Taken Over the Earth Invisibly.
When he says years, he's not exaggerating.
And I had to, yes, I've realized my dream. A few months ago, it actually aired.
It's funny. I mean, the thing that I do think about quite often is I'm Lebanese. We moved over here, I guess, just as I was born. I think a lot about finding the Radiolab stories we can tell from there, about the environmental situation there, which is catastrophic, or about the sectarian relationships. I don't know what it would be, but it's just a personal curiosity I've always had. And I dream about somehow dragging the show there at some point.
I accidentally had an almost Lebanese experience a few months ago. I flew to Tel Aviv after having given a commencement speech in Maine. So it was Maine, Philadelphia, JFK, Istanbul, Tel Aviv. So I was tired. And I got into a train to go to Haifa, where I was supposed to go next. And I fell asleep, and I slept through the Haifa stop. I slept through the next stop, the next stop, the next stop, and the next stop. And when Israel's a tiny little country. And when I woke up, there was no more Mediterranean. I was looking out the window at the Mediterranean. And I open up, and now there's barbed wire, which, of course, means that's Lebanon. I got out of there. Where am I? I said, well, you're now next to Lebanon. I said, oh. I said, now how will I? So I get out of the train, and there's all these guys, all soldiers of some kind. And I said, look, I need to figure out a way to get back to Haifa. Is anybody like it? So I said, well, my brother's coming up with laundry, so maybe he'll drive you at least to Netanya, which is a town. I said, okay. So then I'm waiting. And then looks at me and says, wait a second. Are you from Radiolab?
Get out.
And all these parachute people that, whoa, you Jed or Robert? I said, I'm Robert. I said, oh my God. I said, you just knew that from the voice. They say, yeah. So you never know. He could go and buy chiclets in Beirut and go, who are you? Krolwich or the other one?
Funny. Yeah. I'll meet you across the barbed wire sometime.
So the lesson is Radiolab is taking over the world.
Robert Krolwich, Jad Abumrad, and Steve Paulson talking in the Radiolab studios at WNYC in New York. How important is truth in journalism? Can it also be fiction, is what I mean. Tom Wolfe was one of the founders of what was called the New Journalism Movement in the 60s and 70s, and then he moved into fiction with Bonfire of the Vanities, a hugely best-selling novel about Wall Street, which he considered to be a piece of journalism. Well, now he has published a long-awaited new nonfiction novel called Back to Blood, which is set in the Cuban immigrant culture of Miami. Steve Paulson got him to begin with a reading.
Camilo and his father, Nestor's grandfather, were country boys from Camagüey. Nestor's grandfather had visions of getting away from the life of cutting cane and mucking out stables and humping plows. So he and Camilo stealthily built a crude dinghy. They stole two big cafe umbrellas to use as sails and set out one night for Florida. They nearly died 100 times at least from sunstroke, dehydration, starvation, storms, towering waves, currents gone amok, winds gone dead, and God knows what else before reaching Key West 12 days later, all at the point of death.
That is wonderful. Why did you want to write a novel set in Miami?
My real plan was to write a novel about immigration, because this was at a time when there were lots of great stories about how people got into this country as immigrants, and there were so many stories of people who died trying to do that. And so I was sort of looking around, then I heard that Miami is the only city in the world in which people from another country, I'm talking about the Cubans now, people from another country with a different language and an entirely different culture took over our entire metropolitan area through the voting machine.
Which is astonishing. I mean, just such a short period of time.
Oh, it's just, you know, barely a generation.
So this is interesting. I mean, basically what you're saying is you're bringing your old journalistic background into what you do as a fiction writer. I mean, sort of taking those journalistic instincts and saying, well, here's a great story. Let's do it as a novel.
Oh, when people criticize my work as journalistic, I take it as praise. Oh, yeah, of course it's journalistic. I'm so thankful for working 10 years on a newspaper as a reporter, because one of the things you find out is how much you can learn about the outside world if you are willing to walk up to total strangers and say, you have some information that interests me very much. In fact, I'd like to have that information. In fact, I must have that information. And it's amazing how well that works and how easy it is to do.
So did you also continue to wear your white suits when you were sort of walking around the streets of Miami?
No. I never wear a white suit out on an assignment because it's like, you know, a white suit, let's face it, it's a little bit of showboating involved. But I wasn't fit. I gave up trying to really fit in a long time ago when I was covering a stock car driver, a NASCAR driver named Junior Johnson. It was in western North Carolina, and I knew that I'd be going to races. And I figured, well, you kind of dress down for automobile race. So I wore a green tweed suit with a blue button-down shirt and a black knit necktie. I had a fedora from Borsellino in Italy. And I said, well, now I'm ready for the races. Well, I'm not kidding about this. I've been there for about 3 days, and Junior Johnson was a nice guy. He was a real country boy in the best sense. He said, Tom, I don't mean to say anything, but, you know, all my friends are saying, who is that little green man following you? And that kind of taught me that it was no use my trying to fit in. I might as well have come in a tuxedo as wearing that suit. I was the only suit and tie in 50 miles, I think, in any direction. Now I come on as the man from Mars. You know, I don't know what you're doing, but I'm really interested. And I mean it. Huh. I'm really interested. Hey, what is going on?
Well, it's so interesting hearing you describe how you approach doing your research because, I mean, you're still a journalist, but you're writing fiction now, which does make me wonder, why don't you still write nonfiction? I mean, why did you switch to writing novels?
Well, I meant to write one novel just to show that I could do it because I was getting ready to write a nonfiction novel, and every single chapter was going to be based on reporting. So I was in the office of Harper's Magazine, and while I was standing around, I got a little nosy, and I went into David Halberstam's office. He wasn't there. And on his desk was an invitation to a party at the home of Leonard Bernstein for the Black Panthers. The Bernstein house was a duplex at 895 Park Avenue. I said, my God, the Black Panthers are visiting Park Avenue? I've got to see this. So I assumed that there was a phone number, that if I called that number, there'd be somebody on some committee writing down acceptances. So I called up and said, I'm Tom Wolfe, I accept. And sure enough, it was a security check at the entrance to the apartment. My name was on the list, so... Hmm. That was one of the most bizarre events I've ever seen in my life. But the problem was, in terms of my nonfiction novel, as soon as I saw this event, the old fire bell rang again. And I had to put this into print as soon as possible. I couldn't wait for this nonfiction novel. What am I talking about?
Now, there's one other subculture that I want to talk about, one that you skewer in your book, and that's the modern art world. Why are you so intrigued by the business and culture of contemporary art?
My belief is that the entire art world, as it's now constituted, is controlled by maybe 3,000 people in or near New York City who completely determine what is considered great art. And here's what we've come up with today, and that going that route. There are two new forms of art, new to me anyway. One is called no-hands art, and that's a good example is Jeff Koons, who, he builds 40, he doesn't build them, he doesn't touch them, 45-foot-high bunny rabbits.
When you say he doesn't do them, he has his assistants do them.
Yeah, he has his elves do it. He also does these balloon blow-ups that people can do at carnivals. You twist the balloon this way and that, you can end up with something like a dog. He has these done, and then he has them covered in silver or gold. And they sell for, extraordinary sums. We're talking about, in some cases, more than $1 million for the toy balloon. He also had himself photographed with a famous Italian prostitute. I think she was famous because she had been the center of a scandal in Italy. And he had some photographs taken of the two of them having at it about any way you could possibly penetrate any orifice in the human body. And these photographs, which he didn't take and never touched, were sent to elves in Switzerland and turned into three-dimensional glass objects, also bringing millions. These are the sides of contemporary art that, to me, make great journalism. I have never passed an aesthetic judgment, not one, on anything in the art world that I have written about. I just have described exactly what's going on. My attitude in writing about it is to say, hey, look at that, and look at that one over, look at that one. And in a country like this, things are so bizarre. I love it. You're not going to run out of fabulous material. I think if you settle in anywhere in this country for 30 days, the most miserable little town you ever heard of, and you're going to find great stories. Just if you leave the building, a lot of writers don't understand that, if you leave the building and look around and take notes or record conversations, that's all that it takes. And reporting is, there's no skill to reporting. It's very simple.
Well, you know what they say. It takes a master to make something look simple. Tom Wolfe has written more than a dozen books, including The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, The Right Stuff, Bonfire of the Vanities, and now Back to Blood. Steve Paulson talked with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org. There you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. And you can buy a copy of the program, if you like, by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Telling the Story. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strangechamps, with the help of Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.